It is election week, and there are four constitutional amendments on your ballot this weekend. Joining us now to break them down as we turn to him for constitutional amendments darn near every time out, Stephen Procopio is with us. Stephen, welcome back. How are you?
Doing well. Getting a little bit of rain in the area.
It's much, much appreciated rain, to be sure.
Yeah.
So this weekend, before we dive into the amendments, this weekend, this election, I hate to be all like the curmudgeon, but Stephen, I don't really see a whole lot of turnout here. I was talking with Andre Miller from LABI in our last hour, and she was saying that pollster John Cuvion is projecting around 25%. Do you think he's overshooting it?
It's possible. I mean, we didn't have great turnout when there was a governor's race, and now you have sort of some runoffs, and it's an important runoff, but I don't know that, you know, turnout's certainly going to be lower than it was previously.
No, absolutely. All right, we turn to you. We turn to Parr every time out for a breakdown of the amendments. So let's go ahead and do that right now. Amendment 1, deadlines to veto bills and rules for veto sessions. Tell me all about it.
Sure. I mean, we've had the current veto rule since 1974, but we never had any veto sessions until 2021. So we didn't quite really know how that worked. And basically, one chamber of the legislature can cancel a veto session, and they happen every time, for the past 50-ish years. And so we actually had one, and the problem was the veto session fell during a regular session because it was coming after a special session. And so no one knew exactly what to do. So this would clarify that if a special session causes a veto session, or really if there's a veto session during any other session, they can have the veto override votes during that session. You don't have to adjourn or suspend the session you're in. So it's kind of a technical fix for something we hadn't really had to deal with before.
So, yeah, it's a little bit cumbersome the way it plays out right now. This would just kind of smooth out the process to help a veto override fold into a regular session.
That's right. Yeah, and the veto session is still kind of weird and cumbersome, but at least it fixes this. Now, maybe you want to scrap the whole thing and start again. But this fixed a sort of specific technical problem that never came up before.
Well, anytime anybody suggests scrapping the whole thing and starting again, I'm here for it. Because we're talking about four constitutional amendments on a runoff ballot. I mean, we had four other ones on our October ballot, so it just
right.
50 years in the making. And this piecemeal director set of a constitution that we have. I meant to say Jenga tower at this point. So
yeah, that probably feels more right. It keeps getting taller and taller.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk with Stephen Procopio from Parr about the constitutional amendments. Now, a vote against Amendment 1 basically just holds the status quo, right?
That's right. And no one's quite sure what to do if a veto session happens during a regular session. We kind of dealt with it. People made some rules up, and no one seems to have challenged it. So maybe that works. But, you know, some people would prefer that we have like a clear rule in the Constitution that covers this circumstance.
Now, from a practical standpoint, Stephen, if this constitutional amendment is adopted, this would just, through my eyes at least, cause the governor not to veto something until after the session's over with.
Well, the rules for when the governor can veto something don't change. Mm. So that part's the same. He can still, okay. he has some amount of time, depends on exactly when it falls. On terms, he can veto something if 10 days after the governor sees a bill, he has like 20 days to veto it. Session is ended. So that part doesn't change at all. Okay. But it still would cause a veto session to happen 40 days after the session ends.
All right. Well, then that would streamline things a good bit. All right. Amendment number 2, the repeal of inactive special funds in the Constitution.
Right. So this amendment would eliminate 6 funds in the Constitution. But they are inactive. They have either never been active or they've been inactive like for 10, 20 years. One of the funds has $604 in it. The rest of them are empty. It's basically a sort of a cleanup. It's not the biggest reform ever, but it's a way to start getting on taking some of those things off of the Jenga tower pile that we're talking about.
What are the inactive funds, just to kind of give us an idea?
Sure. So the funds are the Atchafalaya Basin Conservation Fund, the Higher Education Partnership Fund, the Millennium Leverage Fund, the Agriculture and Seafoods Product Support Fund, the First Use Tax Trust Fund, and the Louisiana Investment Fund for Life. So I'll point out they all sound pretty good, that there might be useful things, but they haven't been used, and there are other vehicles usually for most of these things.
Okay, so that would be my follow-up there, is how did we get to where we are, where we have these six funds that aren't being used, not being funded, aside from the $604, you said $604 is sitting in one of them. Aside from that, like, how did they come to be?
Well, so they are all a little different. So I don't want to paint with a broad brush. So, for example, the one that had $604, and it had like a trigger that money would go in there if oil and gas production was above a certain base. But then we've never really hit that since, you know, the 80s when that existed. So money just hasn't been going in there. The Millennium Leverage Fund was a tobacco settlement vehicle, but the legislature went a different direction. A lot of these, the rest of them were sort of like, hey, this would be a good idea if we ever had any money. And so they created a constitutional fund, and then money didn't ever really appear.
Okay, so if we vote for this, we get rid of these six funds.
That's right.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, and I know it's a stupid question. What happens to the $604?
So that would go to the general fund.
Okay. All right. Well, we're flush now, so let's find a way to spend it. Amendment three is what?
All right. Amendment three is a property tax break for those people that work in a sort of emergency response. So you know how everyone has, if you own your home, you have a homestead exemption of $75,000?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This would add for emergency responders a up to $25,000 addition to that. It is at the option of the governing authority. So it doesn't just put something on there, but the government would have to sit down at the local level and decide they wanted to do it. And it could be up to $25,000. They might do 10, they might do 15, they might do nothing. So that's optional. And in emergency, first responders include sheriffs, police officers, firefighters, volunteer firefighters. They have to meet certain criteria. Emergency operators and dispatchers, EMS workers. So it's everyone that's sort of involved in first response.
We're talking with Stephen Procopio about the proposed amendments that are on your ballot this coming Saturday. Stephen, I've got to ask a question about this, this one in particular, because
sure.
What is defined as a first responder can vary in real life, can vary based off of the type of emergency. For example, in the event of a hurricane, media outlets can be defined as first responders. Is it going to be hard and fast statewide that determines who gets this exemption if they opt for it locally? Or will there be some room for interpretation on a local level?
So there might be some room for interpretation. But that list I was reading to you, that's in the constitutional amendment.
Yes.
So it doesn't have, unfortunately, Brian, it doesn't have media in there. I don't think that will ever be.
I wasn't asking for the exemption. I was just...
Right.
Wondering if, as so many times in Louisiana's history, wondering if the room for a loophole was left there, because it says and other full-time public employees involved.
Yeah,
with that.
I can't promise that something wouldn't get in there, but there is a list, and so I think we have a pretty good starting. But you're exactly right. Exactly how that gets interpreted is you know, we can't predict that.
Yeah. But nonetheless, a vote for would definitely help out first responders.
Well, so it would help. I mean, this is an issue that we have a shortage of. It's very important, and we want to try and help recruit and retain them because it can be difficult, particularly, you know, crime fighters, sheriffs, deputies, and police officers. So it would help with that. I have to say on the other side, there are people that say, well, why don't we just give them a pay raise instead? And then there's a little issue that particularly people who are early in their careers, they might be renting. So they wouldn't even get the benefit of this. Where someone that later on affords a house,
right.
They would get the benefit, who are probably more established anyway. So it's a little uneven, but you still probably want to support, or a lot of people would probably want to support their police and firefighters and everyone else that's emergency responders. So that's sort of the two sides of this one.
Yeah, it is a raise by lowering your cost of living in that you would have to pay less property tax. You're right, though, about those who rent, although
right.
It would also be encouraging first responders to go ahead and buy a home. I mean,
that's true.
If this were to pass, I can't see EBR in particular saying, no, we're not going to adopt that here because you would have basically more cops in your neighborhoods, living in
it's
your neighborhoods.
True. Well, so. I can't speak to whether locals can do it or not. They'll have to figure out how much it costs and what their path was. But at least this is something that's optional and it wouldn't be foisted on them by, you know, state government.
The fourth amendment on this Saturday's ballot, rule changes for the Revenue Stabilization Trust Fund. This is one that, oh man,
it's a little technical.
Yeah, I got lost in the weeds on this one, Stephen.
Okay, this one is a little tough. So, you know, the rainy day fund, you know, when we have a budget shortfall, we can tap it and then we put some money into it. That is technically the budget stabilization fund. That is something separate, but it's related to this. This is the revenue stabilization fund that we're talking about, which was created in 2016. And any corporate funds that come into the state, anything over $600 million gets put into this fund, which has about $2.2 million in it. $2.2 billion in it.
There you go.
So that's a lot of money. And the way it can be used, there's two main ways it can be used. If you get to $5 billion, then 10% of that can be spent on construction projects. The other way it can be used is with a two-thirds vote. The legislature can spend any of it in any way they want for an emergency, but that emergency isn't defined. So essentially, with two-thirds vote, they can spend this any way they want. So that's how it exists now.
Mm-hmm.
This amendment, the main thing this amendment does is tighten that two-thirds emergency up and says, no, that's only for budget shortfall. If there's going to be a revenue shortfall, either in the current year or the next year, you have to hit the rainy day fund first. And if the rainy day fund doesn't fix it, then you can, with a two-thirds vote, tap this revenue stabilization fund up to $250 million to help with your problem. So it essentially restricts what some people are nervous about, that you just have this giant slush fund you can tap for anything,
mm-hmm.
to say, no, this can now only help with budget shortfalls. So on the one hand, it sort of tightens up what might be considered a loophole, and it helps give us extra protection against, you know, rainy days. So that's sort of the pro side. The other side is, well, no, we want the legislature to have freedom to do these things. We elect them. Let's give them freedom. And if they do something stupid with the money, let's vote them out of office. And we already have a rainy day fund. This would be like rainy day fund 2.0. So this is the technical one. And there's a lot of things to consider on both sides.
Yeah. And this one, and where I kept getting lost on this one, Stephen, and I know it all like individually, but the need for the Revenue Stabilization Trust Fund in the first place, you just spelled it out right there. It's a rainy day fund 2.0.
Well, this would make it into a rainy day 2.0. The original form of it, it's really to try with it. There's two important parts of it. One is it takes corporate revenue over $600 million and puts it in this fund. That in and of itself is useful,
mm-hmm.
because if you build a budget on corporate revenue, it's very volatile. You could have $1 billion in corporate revenue one year and like $100 million the next. And so it adds some instability to the budgeting process. So that's already useful on the front end.
Gotcha.
On the back end is then what do you do with the money? And the idea is eventually this could be like a sovereign fund. And so we get to $5 billion and now we have a continual source of construction money for the state. So that's one of the sort of uses for it. But then they kind of left themselves a pressure valve that, look, if things get really bad, you can break glass. You know, if we have a hurricane, if we have COVID, if we have something that's, you know, undefined, we can still tap it with a two-thirds vote. The issue is, yeah, but you guys are probably going to do something stupid with it. So why don't we tighten and just say, no, only for budget emergencies in the state. And that's what this amendment does.
So this would remove the construction aspect of it?
Mm. No, that still stays.
That stays. So okay.
That's still there. It really is just fixing the two-thirds emergency part to say, no. Essentially, the only emergency you can use it for is for a budget shortfall.
Okay. So rainy day fund helps bolster HB1. Revenue stabilization fund can fund HB2 once it gets to a certain level.
Right. There you go.
All right. He is Stephen Procopio with PAR, the Public Affairs Research Council in Louisiana here. We always appreciate the time and the info, man. It's it can be a jumble before you walk in. So thanks for the clarification.
Always. You know, maybe we'll talk next year. I suspect there'll be some constitutional amendments on the ballot then, too.
You can almost guarantee it, Stephen. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Always fun.